Today's broadcast was originally recorded on April 17th, 2024.
Now, I can't give you an example of enforcing it in a situation where people have violently stormed a building in order to prevent an official proceeding, but that's just because I'm not aware of that circumstance ever happening prior to January 6th.
Right. Right. None of this ever happened until January 6th.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No,
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me and everyone I know. Don't be laughing at that, Desi Doyen.
We do, mostly, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, on Tuesday this week, that clip you heard at the top, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument in a case that challenges the Department of Justice's use of a law barring obstruction of an official proceeding against several hundred of the 1,400 or so who have been indicted and or convicted of crimes for their part in the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. One of those indicted under that statute, and only one of them, happens to be the disgraced former president of the United States, Donald Trump, who, if those challenging this law have their way, well, Donald Trump could see two of the four criminal counts charged against him by special counsel Jack Smith in the case regarding his Trump's attempt to steal the 2020 election. He could see two of the four criminal counts dropped entirely from that indictment. Our guest joining us momentarily, who was in the Supreme Court on Tuesday, will join us to help explain the challenge to that 2002 law, how the justices on the high court appeared to feel about it, and how and if it will affect Trump's federal election theft case that is currently stalled as the corrupted right-wing Supreme Court majority considers Trump's his own claim that presidents have complete and total immunity from any and all crimes, a case that SCOTUS has taken its time to hear, despite the challenge being thoroughly rejected by all of the lower court judges who have heard it to date, even as the court has delayed Trump's trial while they take their time considering that case. Next week, finally, the court is scheduled to hear oral argument in that, which has now likely prevented Americans from learning whether Trump will be convicted or acquitted in that particular matter in advance of this year's election. But I'm happy to say that we'll be able to cover the court's oral argument on Tuesday of this week, because our planned special coverage for the first ever impeachment of a sitting presidential cabinet member, in this case, Joe Biden's Department of Homeland Security Chief Alejandro Mayorkas, well, our special coverage is canceled today. Why? Well, we reported yesterday on the GOP House, which finally was able to adopt the articles of impeachment against Mayorkas after two tries at it way back in February. Republicans finally, on Tuesday this week, walked the articles across the Capitol to formally present them to the U.S. Senate for an impeachment trial. On Wednesday, then, as mandated under the rules for impeachment, all U.S. senators were sworn in as jurors to witness the trial to determine whether Mayorkas would be removed from office for his alleged high crimes and misdemeanors. Well, the first impeachment article against him accused the DHS chief of, quote, willfully and systemically, unquote, refusing to comply with federal immigration laws. The second article charged him with making false statements to Congress, specifically that, in his opinion, the border is, quote, secure. That became a high crime and misdemeanor. 67 votes would have been needed to remove Mayorkas from office. Some Senate Republicans joined Democrats in agreeing that he did not actually commit any impeachable offenses, that what House GOPers found to be high crimes or misdemeanors were actually just policy disagreements that they had with the administration. But before we could even make it to air today, it was all over. Both articles have been dismissed by the Senate, where Democrats, who enjoy a two-seat majority, voted to rule both impeachment articles unconstitutional because they did not rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors as required by the Constitution. So the trial was then adjourned. So that was a whole lot of GOP Sturm und Drang for nothing, or in this case, a revenge impeachment on behalf of the twice impeached former president, all of which amounted to nothing and was and only adopted by House GOPers in this case because they haven't been able to come up with any reason whatsoever to impeach Joe Biden. So special impeachment coverage now ended. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi. You're welcome. We didn't waste your time with that.
No. We've got many other things to waste your time with today. Before we get to our guest, there is a bit more news of note to mention quickly here. State House Republicans in Arizona on Wednesday scuttled another effort to repeal the state's 1864 law banning abortion, defying pressure from prominent Republicans, including former President Trump, who had urged them to toss the ban that many voters viewed as extreme and archaic, according to the New York Times, but only because it is extreme and archaic.
Exactly.
But Arizona Republicans in the legislature, despite meeting just once a week and having a very having very narrow majorities, I think one seat majorities in both both chambers of the state legislature, well, they were having nothing of it. Quote, the last thing we should be doing today is rushing a bill through the legislative process to repeal a law that has been enacted and reaffirmed by the legislature several times, said House Speaker Ben Toma, a Republican, as he blocked an effort to even vote on the appeal. You may remember that last week Toma vowed he would never allow a vote to repeal this this law. The Biden-Harris campaign, no doubt, is sending Mr. Toma a huge bouquet of flowers as a thank you gift at this point. The ruling by Arizona's all-Republican state Supreme Court last week to uphold the Civil War-era near-total abortion ban infuriated supporters of abortion rights. It exhilarated abortion opponents, and it set off an absolute political firestorm in Arizona. And for that matter, around the nation, as the extreme autocratic position of Republicans on this matter and their need to ensure big government controls over the bodily autonomy of women, all of that becomes clearer by the day to voters in advance of November's, or should I say Rovember's, elections at this point. Repealing the law, which allows only an exception to save the life of the mother, and says doctors prosecuted under the law could face fines and prison terms of 2 to 5 years, would then revert Arizona to the GOP's 15-week abortion ban. But apparently, even that is not good enough for them. They could repeal this 160-year-old law and still have this 15-week ban that they passed. But nope, not good enough, apparently. Republicans initially resisted Democrats' attempt to repeal the law last week, but Trump and Carrie Lake, the Republican Senate candidate and close pal of Donald Trump, who had previously and repeatedly lauded the 160-year-old ban on abortion, Carrie Lake had. She had lauded that over and over again. It was adopted some 50 years before Arizona became a state, before women had the right to vote, while black people were still slaves in this country. Well, Carrie Lake reversed her position last week after favoring the law for years. She charged that the state's high court had overreached. She urged the legislature to act quickly to repeal that law. They haven't. Lake faces a highly competitive race for the U.S. Senate this year against Democrat Ruben Gallego in the battleground state that narrowly voted for Joe Biden over Donald Trump in 2020. That margin could be broader this year, given the debate over this 1864 law and the fact that proponents of reproductive rights are also planning to include a constitutional amendment to protect those rights in Arizona on this year's ballot. On Wednesday, according to the Times, it initially appeared as though efforts by Trump and Lake to see the full ban overturned might pay off. Democrats signaled that they were optimistic of having enough Republican support to secure a majority to send the repeal bill to the state Senate. But when one Democrat rose to bring forward her bill to repeal the ban, Republicans successfully prevented a vote on procedural grounds. Said Democratic State Rep. Alma Hernandez, quote, "The fact that we will not even entertain a motion to allow those who have been raped or became pregnant by incest to be able to have an abortion is extremely disappointing," she said. Moments later, the Republican chair gaveled the House into recess. Now, the legislative body has yet to adjourn, at least as we go to air, and it was not immediately clear if there would be more votes later in the day. That's possible. But given the Speaker of the House, Ben Thoma's vow to never allow this up for a vote, well, seems unlikely, but we will keep our eyes on it. And speaking of Rovember elections, Alabama Democrats in the state's newly redrawn 2nd Congressional District voted in a primary election runoff on Tuesday this week, in which front-running Shamari figures easily bested Anthony Daniels following an 11-person free-for-all primary back on Super Tuesday on March 5th. So this was the primary runoff. What is most important, however, about this race in the state's 2nd Congressional District is that the district itself has been redrawn this year under court order to comply with the Voting Rights Act as a second U.S. House district for the state that will allow black voters a chance to elect a representative of their own choosing. And that has wildly goosed voter turnout in the 2nd District this year. As USA Today reported earlier this week, voter turnout for the Democratic primary in Alabama's 2nd Congressional District was remarkably higher in the first election since the district was redrawn in a way that could allow the party to pick up a key seat. According to the National Redistricting Foundation, there were 57,129 ballots cast in the district's initial Democratic primary election on Super Tuesday. That was a 133% increase over the 24,400 ballots that were cast in 2022 in the Democratic primary.
Wow, wow, wow. So fair elections do improve voter turnout.
Quote, voting in local elections is just as, if not more, important, said Emily Smith, a University of Alabama graduate who drove 4 hours round trip from Tuscaloosa to her polling place to vote in person. She said, I think my generation has really seen the impacts of voting as well as not voting. Good point. Last summer, as you may recall, we covered it closely on this program, the case of Allen v. Milligan, in which the U.S. Supreme Court, in a surprising ruling that really stunned all of us, and I should say pleased all of us, at least those of us who believe in voting rights, the Supreme Court held 5-4 that the state's Alabama state Republicans, their proposed congressional district map was unconstitutionally racially gerrymandered. It discriminated against black voters, and the court ordered a second congressional district.
You know it's bad when even the supermajority on the U.S. Supreme Court says you have gone too far.
The state initially refused to do so, however, defying the high court order. But a new map was eventually drawn by the federal court, offering the opportunity now for a second minority district. I believe there are 7 districts in Alabama. About a third of the population is black, and yet there was only one district in which it was even possible for a black candidate to win. Now there are 2. Quote, it's clear that Alabama's representative map is a boon for political participation. That's great news for democracy, said Marina Jenkins, the executive director of the National Redistricting Foundation. She added, quote, when voters know they have the opportunity to elect a candidate of their choice, they are more motivated to show up to the polls and fulfill their civic duties. Dawson Wilcox, an incoming student at Berkeley Law, said he believes the increased voter turnout comes down to general enthusiasm from the results of Allen v. Milligan. Quote, the Montgomery area is very politically diverse and a vast swath of the population has never had a chance to make their voices heard at the federal level, he said. Also, giving black Alabamians more of a voice will improve voter turnout in November, he said, saying that, quote, apathy is the enemy of democracy. Bill Foster, executive director of, Ephraim South, said he believes having a young guy who's charismatic, referring to Democratic candidate Shamari Figures, who ended up winning the primary runoff election this week, also caused a lot of young people to turn out to vote in the primary. He also said some people are simply doing everything they can to vote against former President Donald Trump. Yes, even in Alabama. Kathy Jones, the president of the League of Women Voters of Alabama, said, quote, this is showing what could happen if you had districts that were actually fair. When you've got an equal chance of winning, then you're going to have people wanting to participate. In fact, Republican turnout for their primary was high as well, though not quite as high as in the Democratic contest last month. But Republicans in the state, they are not giving up their effort at voter suppression and election interference. Since the primary just last month on Super Tuesday, in the wake of unprecedented Democratic turnout in the 2nd District, state Republicans have implemented a new law that criminalizes some aspects of absentee voter ballot assistance. Advocacy groups are now suing public officials again over that new law. So the beat goes on, but at least in some parts of the country, the good guys and, well, democracy are winning a few. But the good guys in democracy were up against it this week at the U.S. Supreme Court regarding accountability for January 6 insurrectionists, including our disgraced former president. That story with Law Dork's Chris Geidner, who was at the high court for this week's historic oral argument. He joins us next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Welcome back. It's The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Of the roughly 1,400 Donald Trump supporters charged with crimes for their participation in the Trump-incited U.S. Capitol insurrection on January 6, 2021, about 350 of them have faced or are facing charges under a 2002 federal law that forbids, quote, obstructing or impeding any official proceeding or attempting to do so. In fact, two of the four criminal felony charges that Donald Trump himself is facing in Special Counsel Jack Smith's federal indictment against him related to his attempts to steal the 2020 election, including via the 2021 attack and insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, are based on this specific statute. One count charges that Trump obstructed the official proceedings in Congress by attempting to block the joint session of Congress from their solemn constitutionally mandated duty of opening, counting, and certifying the Electoral College votes in favor of Joe Biden that year. And another count against Trump is for conspiring with others to obstruct those official proceedings. Well, on Tuesday this week at the U.S. Supreme Court, the justices heard arguments in an appeal that challenges the use of that statute. The challenge comes from a guy named Joseph Fisher, a man who was, during the January 6 insurrection, a member of Pennsylvania's North Cornwall Township Police. Fisher is accused of charging at police guarding a Capitol entrance during the attack in order to corruptly obstruct the counting of electoral votes. Prosecutors have documented how Fisher got inside the building and pressed up against an officer's riot shield as police were attempting to clear the area. He was charged with, among other things, violating Section 1512C2. Of the Federal Criminal Code, a provision adopted as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act back in 2002, a statute that grew out of the government's response to the Enron scandal. 1512C has two parts to it, only the second of which Fisher is charged with. As Law Dork's Chris Geidner explains today in his newsletter, the placement of both the first provision and second provision next to each other in 1512C has been key to the challenges to prosecutions under this law. 1512C specifically cites a violation of law for, quote, whoever corruptly, one, alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record, document, or other object, or attempts to do so with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding, or two, otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so. Anyone who does either of those two things, quote, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both. Fisher is charged under the second provision, that's C2, otherwise obstructing or impeding an official proceeding or attempting to do so. It was one of about six different charges against Fisher, and as noted, hundreds of January 6 insurrectionists have been charged with and or found guilty of that crime by about a dozen different judges in D.C. But in Fisher's case, U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols, a Trump appointee, dismissed the obstruction charge against him, ruling that it applies only to defendants who also tampered with evidence, as mentioned in the first part of the statute. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit reversed Judge Nichols' decision, prompting Fisher then to appeal to SCOTUS, where his case was heard in oral argument on Tuesday. Obviously, this matter could have major implications for the prosecutions and sentences for hundreds of already charged and/or convicted January 6 insurrectionists, and that includes Jack Smith's indictment of Donald Trump, given that two different counts out of four reference this particular statute. Might the corrupt, far-right, 6-3 Republican majority on the court take this opportunity to do the former president, three of whom were actually appointed by him, yet another solid by undermining 1512C2, the statute barring obstruction or interference of an official proceeding, by mandating that it must also involve the destruction, mutilation, or concealment of documents, as in the first part of that statute? And if the High Court did so, would that actually result in the tossing of the two related charges pending against the four-time indicted former president? Joining us now is our friend, recovering lawyer Chris Geidner, a veteran legal journalist who was actually in the courtroom at the Supreme Court for oral argument in Fisher v. U.S. on Tuesday. Mr. Geidner, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Hello.
Good to have you here. I've got a lot to ask you about on this case. But first, Chris, the corrupt 75-year-old Justice Clarence Thomas was not at oral arguments for other cases on Monday. But unlike previous absences, Chief Justice John Roberts did not explain Thomas's absence that day, other than to say that he would participate in the cases by reading the transcripts, etc. In the past, when Thomas or others have been sick or something, Roberts has said as much, but not this time. So let's see, sort of a four-part question for you, Chris. A, was Thomas there live on Tuesday? B, what happened to him on Monday? C, have we learned if he was, you know, busy painting Harlan Crow's garage or something? And D, did he recuse from this case on Tuesday, given that his wife actually participated in the insurrection in various ways, including being at the rally on January 6 and texting Trump's chief of staff that the election was a, quote, heist?
Yeah, I don't remember the order, but
okay.
the Thomas was not there on Monday. We still do not know why he was not there Monday. He appeared on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. We were given no explanation at that point of why he was back and what had happened the day before. And he participated fully in the case on Tuesday, so he will not be recusing himself.
And so we assume that means he will not be recusing himself from anything that has to do with January 6th at this point.
I mean, yeah. I think that was sort of decided when he participated in the 14th Amendment case.
But gotcha.
Sure, this was a little more directly January 6th, mm-hmm. since it was actually criminal charges mm-hmm. out of January 6th. Mm-hmm. But obviously, the 14th Amendment case about the Colorado ruling removing Trump from the ballot was certainly January 6th related. So
okay.
I think we would have known then if Thomas was going to be keeping out of these cases, but this further confirmed that.
Gotcha. Well, then I guess I'm starting to think Clarence Thomas may be corrupt himself. Anyway, Chris Geidner, the headline, the first line really, and really the overall thrust of your coverage today of Tuesday's oral argument in your Law Dork newsletter sort of jumped out at me, citing what you describe as several of the court's Republican appointees expressing a, quote, newfound concern about over-criminalization of our justice system. That is sort of a new thing, isn't it? At least when it comes to criminalization for things other than, you know, white-collar crimes like bribery and so forth. What, in your estimation, Chris, explains this newfound concern among the court's Republicans here about, you know, too much criminalization against criminal indictees?
I mean, honestly, part of me feels like it just shows the willful ignorance at other times. It would be easy enough to say, like, oh, they're in on Stop the Steal, and that's why they did this today on Tuesday. I mean, I don't think it's even so much that as the fact that, like, they can have these discussions when they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they're not willing to in so many other cases mm-hmm. is what was, for me, as somebody who covers, for example, like all of the challenges to death sentences, mm-hmm. who covers all of the other disputes about the way language should be interpreted. Sort of in the run-up to this set of arguments, I did mention something that you referenced mm-hmm. Here that yeah, basically the only criminal laws that the court is poised generally to interpret narrowly are corruption statutes.
Yep.
And otherwise, it really does depend on, I mean, what I said last week was it depends on what Justice Gorsuch thinks and whether he can bring over other justices to his side. And that is something that I got into a little in this piece about Tuesday, is that, I mean, Neil Gorsuch does have a history on the bench of pushing back at government prosecutorial authority.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not as much as like a criminal defense lawyer might,
mm-hmm.
But he does. He is willing to in certain cases. And so I
but he's almost, sort of the only one. He's sort of the only one of the justices,
and
especially
on
the right.
Take, yeah. I take his questions on Tuesday pretty much at face value that he would raise these sorts of questions. And he asked, like, if the government's interpretation of this second statute that you discussed, this C2,
mm-hmm.
is removed from C1 and can sort of be a catch-all obstruction statute, he asked, what does that mean for the breadth of this statute? Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify? Or at the State of the Union address? And then, sort of a weird question, he said, would pulling a fire alarm before a vote qualify for 20 years in federal prison?
Yeah.
Which felt... rather, it was like I think I wrote vague yet pointed reference to Representative Jamal Bowman
right.
setting off the fire alarm in the Cannon Building last fall. It was this question of like, well, what would this interpretation mean if we're able to do this here?
Well, and it sounds, Chris, sort of like a legitimate question. And before I get into the answers to that, to some of those questions from Gorsuch and some of the others, I just want to make sure I'm understanding this case. We've got these two provisions of this law. The first provision says that, you know, you can't destruct evidence, documents, and so forth. And again, this was written following the Enron scandal, so, you know, they had financial issues in mind and so forth. Certainly, corporate issues. That's the first part. Then the second part, you know, says. Or otherwise, obstructing an official proceeding. Now, is the argument here that you have to do both of those things in order to be charged with this particular provision?
No, not both. But what the Jeffrey Green, the lawyer for Fisher,
mm-hmm.
Yesterday argued was that the fact that the second provision begins with otherwise. It says otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding. It has to be connected to the first one because it's saying otherwise. And so therefore, his argument is that it's only that obstruction or attempted obstruction related to evidence.
I don't understand how otherwise that seems to make it a separate clause entirely. And there was some.
It is, but yeah. The question, I mean, the question was asked, if you interpret it in the DOJ's way, what work does otherwise do? I forget who asked that, but somebody asked that almost that exact question.
Yeah.
What work does otherwise do? If you're interpreting the statute as the introductory phrase is whoever corruptly, and that applies to both of them.
Right.
And so you're interpreting it as whoever corruptly otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so. If you don't require any reference back to one, what work is otherwise doing? And there's basically a rule in statutory interpretation that a word can't have no point.
Well, the meaning seems quite clear. Whether it was, you know, lousy grammar or not, it seems quite clear. And Sonia Sotomayor, she sort of pushed back against the Fisher argument here. Saying that, you know, essentially otherwise in the second, the word otherwise in the second part of 1512C is a separate matter from whether they also violated the first part of 1512C that bars destruction of documents and evidence and so forth, that you don't have to do both. Here was Justice Sonia Sotomayor's question sort of offering a pretty clear example of how this would work in pretty much any other case.
Let me give you an example. There is a sign on the theater. You will be kicked out of the theater if you photograph or record the actors or otherwise disrupt the performance. If you start yelling, I think no one would question that you can be expected to be kicked out under this policy, even though yelling has nothing to do with photograph or recording. The object that the verb is looking at, the verbs are looking at, is the obstruction. It's not the manner in which you obstruct, it's the fact that you've obstructed. Isn't that the structure of this provision?
Yeah. That does sort of seem to be exactly the structure of this provision. If you, you know, take photographs or otherwise disrupt, and you disrupt without actually taking photographs, you would still be kicked out of the theater. How did Fisher respond?
Their argument, the argument on that side, which is essentially that, I mean, honestly, both sides come down to statutory drafting is difficult.
Right.
And I mean, Solicitor General Praligar, who's incredible, essentially said, like, this is a catch-all provision.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the government got burned by Enron. They saw that they needed to fix the law to address problems that had allowed people to get away with too much. Mm-hmm. Then they passed this, and in passing that, they basically acknowledged that essentially you can look at it as C1 being fixing the problem from this time, and C2 is setting forth the possibility of, I think somebody said yesterday, the known unknowns.
Right, exactly. The things we haven't thought of yet that might violate this.
Somebody might come up with some way around C1, but we want to address anything that is going to obstruct or impede any official proceeding.
Now, Justice Clarence Thomas, you write, was very concerned about this statute only being used in this way suddenly now in these January 6 cases, despite the fact that there have been, as he charged, quote, many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings. He asked the Solicitor General Elizabeth Preliger, quote, has the government applied this provision to other protests in the past, and has this been the government's position throughout the lifespan of this statute, unquote. Sort of sounds like a gotcha question to me, Chris. How did Preliger respond to Thomas's query on that point, if this has ever been used before, if it's now only being used on the J6 defendants?
Yeah, this was I feel like there was almost an effort by Preliger not to make these arguments seem political. Mm-hmm. But when sort of backed into a corner, which happened a few times at the arguments, she really came out with the full-fledged argument. And she basically said, I can't give you an example of this exact thing. And she said, mm-hmm. enforcing it in a situation where people have violently stormed a building in order to prevent an official proceeding, a specified one, mm-hmm. from occurring, with all of the elements like intent to obstruct, knowledge of the proceeding, having the corrupt mens rea. But that's just because I'm not aware of that circumstance ever happening prior to January
6th. Yep.
So she essentially said, the reason we don't have examples mm-hmm. is that there are no examples.
Right, exactly.
Like, we don't have prosecutions because there are several things that you need to prove in order to, yes, there are violent protests, but they're not violent protests of official government proceedings.
Well, let me
like that's the difference here, because there were some attempts to try to, like, I forget who, but somebody sort of like leaned into like protests in the summer 2020 mm-hmm. and protests in Portland, but like those were literally over the weekend, they were overnight. Mm-hmm. This wasn't, and they weren't directed at a specific proceeding in federal court. They were outside of the federal courthouse.
Well, you raised earlier the point that Neil Gorsuch made, asking, you know, what it sounds like a legit question when it comes to defining what amounts to obstructing an official proceeding. Let me play his question here, and I'll get your response after.
Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify, or at the State of the Union address? Would pulling a fire alarm before a vote qualify for 20 years in federal prison?
So that sounds reasonable. That would be obstructing an official proceeding if you stood up and you heckled at the Supreme Court and the court had to stop for a minute or two while you were removed. So it sounds reasonable. Those would all be obstruction of an official proceeding. How did the Solicitor General respond to that?
Yeah, this was where she sort of laid out the elements of the offense. Like, you can talk in a non-lawyerly way about, like, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. But in order to get a conviction, that statute that we've been talking about lays out specific things that you need to prove. That opening that we discussed, the whoever corruptly.
The corruptly.
Corruptly,
yeah.
Is an element of the offense. So mm-hmm. you have to prove that corruptly. You have to prove that there was knowledge of the fact that there was an official proceeding. Mm-hmm. You have to show knowledge that they intended to obstruct or impede that proceeding. And so she sort of laid out in these January 6 cases in a later question with Justice Kagan, that she said that for each of these, that despite the fact that there have been more than 1,000 people charged, they've only brought this charge in a little more than 300 of the cases.
Right. They weren't.
And for those cases, she said that they went through and they proved that the defendant, they found evidence that the defendant knew about the proceedings, knew that they were happening in the joint session of Congress that day, that they specifically intended to prevent Congress from certifying the vote, and that they knew that what they were doing was wrongful or unlawful conduct.
And yet, all the people who have been charged and convicted of this, the justices kept sort of returning to the, you know, are all of these things a crime that is worth, 20 years in prison? They kept leaning on that sort of that the state's, 20-year maximum sentence and so forth. Have any of the defendants, the hundreds of J6 defendants who were convicted under this law, actually received 20 years in prison that would be allowable under this law? Or anything close to it? No.
No. There was a penalty enhancement that had been applied in some of the earlier sentencing that the D.C. Circuit has since said shouldn't apply, and that will throw down the numbers even more. But even with that enhancement, what the Solicitor General said yesterday is that I forget, she used both like average, mean, median, and I'm a lawyer, not a mathematician.
Right.
I forget what means what,
right.
But there's a slight difference between those two numbers.
Right.
But one of them was like 24 months with this penalty and one was 26 months. So even with the penalty enhancement that's going to be removed, none of these people are getting more than 2 years and 2 months.
Nothing close to 20 years.
So nothing close to 20 years.
Chris, I've seen a lot of various reactions to the oral arguments on Tuesday. Some observers saying that, oh, yes, there are five justices who seemed opposed to the DOJ's view of this matter. Others who said the so-called conservatives on the bench were not all completely hostile to the government's position. What was your take before we get to the ramifications of how they might decide? What was your take from in the courtroom with the caveat that, trying to read tea leaves from questions at oral arguments is a fraught matter and it may be a terrible idea?
It's really tough to read the Chief Justice's questions. He didn't ask any questions of Green, the lawyer for Fisher. He only asked questions of the SG, so that they were pointed questions, but it's possible that he mostly agrees with DOJ and he was pushing back on what he thought were their weakest arguments. So we don't quite know what he meant, and while Alito and Thomas both seemed sympathetic to Fisher's arguments and questioned the SG harshly, they both suggested at different times that there was a rationality behind the SG's argument, the government's approach. Certainly, we saw that Justices Barrett and Jackson appeared to be looking for a potential middle ground toward the end of argument, throughout the arguments, that would essentially basically add another thing to that list that the Solicitor General had been talking about that prosecutors would need to prove in order to get a conviction under this provision that would have to do with the action intending to limit the availability of the documents. So now that could be, depending on how it's written, even so much as just like preventing them from meeting.
Well,
like you're limiting the availability of the documents if you're preventing the joint session from meeting and the vice president actually opening the certification.
Because there was documents and evidence involved here, which brings me to the, if this provision, let's say a best case scenario, they do find one of those, that sort of middle ground you're talking about, if it's narrowed in some way, the use of this provision, or even if it's tossed entirely for use in January 6 cases, what does that mean, Chris Geidner, for the hundreds of January 6 defendants who are currently in jail or facing jail in general? And specifically, what would it mean for Jack Smith's use of two of his four federal counts brought against Donald Trump relating to January 6th in the 2020 election that rely on this very provision of federal law.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of what this decision is, if they change the elements of what the government needs to prove at all, it's going to cause anybody who's been sentenced under this to seek resentencing, to seek further review, to have their convictions tossed altogether, to force the government to reprove those elements. Basically, at one point yesterday, the Solicitor General suggested that the assault charges for some of these people could actually be higher sentences. So it's possible that depending on what happens with this, the government might not even try to retry on some of these charges. For Jack Smith, now, obviously, due to Trump's delay, in some ways, Trump's delay might make this better for Jack Smith because the trial has not started at all, so Jeopardy hasn't attached. Mm-hmm. And so he hasn't tried to prove anything of those charges. He might need to file a superseding indictment that adds to those charges with whatever additional information if it already isn't contained in the indictment as is. But if you remember, the Trump indictment from Jack Smith in D.C. was a long so-called speaking indictment. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more than what happened in a lot of these January 6th cases that do involve documents. If you remember all of the information about the false electors.
Yep.
So even if there is a more centralized reading of documents, it's entirely possible that what we already have in the Trump indictment will allow this charge to go forward. But I do think that once we get a decision, Trump's lawyers will be looking for any way to use that decision to either challenge the foundation for those charges or at least to be able to get them to lose that trial.
Yeah, my argument is that Jack Smith has sort of already preempted this particular argument, saying that, yeah, there are documents involved here, specifically the electoral certificates, which they were trying to replace.
The
false ones, right. So that would be
the made-up ones that were like devised in a side room because they weren't allowed in the chamber.
Right. And yet, you know, all of this kind of drives me crazy, Chris, because this is all because of, what do we make of that word otherwise? We want to make sure that the word otherwise is properly accounted for. And yet we spoke with you a couple weeks ago about, you know, the 14.3, the 14th Amendment Section 3, which is really damn clear down to every word. And they just didn't care. They just added on something on top of it. It's got to be a Congress has to pass a law. Nothing like that is said anywhere in the Constitution. But here, when it's a law that they want to sort of undermine, I don't know about that word otherwise. That might change everything. It's kind of maddening, Chris.
It's not always the easiest way to report on these with me being able to give any sort of logical coherence to what's happening.
Well, that's the problem. It's like if they were
which
always
is their
like
one
this.
Job.
Yeah, exactly. If they did this all the time in every case, that would be one thing. But they sort of pick and choose in all of these different cases. Really, it seems to get the outcome that they want. Chris, I got to get out here, but very quickly, there is, of course, another big oral argument related to all of this at the Supreme Court, scheduled for, I think, next Thursday, if I recall.
Yes.
On the matter of Trump's claim that presidents have absolute and total immunity for any and all crimes that they committed as president. So very quickly, are you planning to be at the court for that one? And I don't know if it's possible in 30 seconds, but what are your expectations for how that one is likely to play out?
Yeah, I will be in the court next Thursday for the Trump immunity arguments. Mm-hmm. And we expect that to go similarly, but the opposite of the 14th Amendment arguments. Uh-huh. And we still think that the arguments advanced by Trump are have no foundation in history, in practice, or in experience. And there is a very strong case for imagining that we're going to get a 9-0 decision against Trump in that case, still, even with this court.
Okay.
But
okay.
Remember,
yes. Yeah.
The bottom line here is that Trump will still have delayed
right.
the case since Judge Chutkan denied this request for the case to be dismissed on yep. this grounds back on December 1st.
Yep.
And it will be at least in May before we get a ruling on this. So in some ways, win, lose, or draw, he has won if the goal here is to avoid the possibility of a conviction on these charges
yep.
before the election is held in November.
Yeah, they can both give him the gift of delaying this thing for months and look like heroes if they decide 9-0 that Donald Trump, you're wrong and you're welcome. Chris Geidner is the recovering lawyer, veteran legal journalist who writes the Law Dork newsletter, which you can and should sign up for at lawdork.com. You can follow him as Chris Geidner on Twitter and at Law Dork News at that same site. Chris, always great speaking with you, my friend. We probably are going to do it more and more this year as all of this madness continues. So thank you in advance, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I will say this, Desi Doyen.
I
feel somewhat better after talking to Chris and after coming to understand that Jack Smith has understood this particular challenge and has said that his case, his use of those two counts against Donald Trump for obstructing an official
right.
proceeding, also include documents, the false, the fake elector scheme.
In other words, he's ready for that.
It does seem like he is. So even if they end up narrowing this at the Supreme Court in some way, I think the counts against Trump will continue anyway in
okay.
that that one of four criminal cases that Trump's now facing.
We shall see.
We shall see indeed. Got to get out. My thanks to our producer Desi Doyen, of course, to our once again to our guest Chris Geidner, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. That is made possible by listeners like you, kind enough to stop by bradblog.com/donate and help us stay on your public airwaves. My thanks always, particularly to those of you who sign up for a subscription of any amount you like. Bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.